I used to think my daddy would come to save me.
Maddie and Jack sat together in the cage once more. She was sitting beside him, her knees tucked close to her chest, gazing off into the distance at nothing in particular. After Jack's vicious interrogation, all the children had been returned to the cattle truck that held their cage. Jack had been stripped of the throwing knife he had hidden in one sleeve and other secret places, as well as the one he'd had held in his hand when he had been captured by Adam. The Sekhmen had patted him down, but they had failed to check his boots, and so had missed the two additional leaf-bladed knives he had hidden there. The other children had been stripped of their weapons, the guns they had acquired, as well as the knife-like stakes that Jack had hewn from the wooden wall of their prison. They sat around quietly, dejected, and resenting Jack for the flash of hope he had shown them that had amounted to nothing. But mostly, he knew, the children were in shock at what had happened to one of their own, Francis Frankie. Every last one of them knew that that was Jack's fault, too. The door had been replaced, and the screws and the hinges hastily welded in place by a Sekhmen with an acetylene welding torch.
The first day I was here, I thought, sooner or later, Daddy will come aboard and rescue me, and I can go back home and everything will be the same again. Then they took Hugo. An old grandpa and a pretty lady with a notebook came, and they opened the cage door and they took Hugo. She said he had a really important job to do for them.
Hugo?
He's 9 years old, Jack. I don't think he was even scared. He just went with them, and I heard him tell the lady how pretty her hair was. And that was the last time we saw him. He didn't come back. 3 days ago, if you want to know. That's when Hugo left.
They say where?
No, just for the really important job. Don't know what. Back on the farm, my mom would give me really important jobs, too. Like picking the sweet cherries from the tree and taking Rufus... He's our dog. Taking Rufus out to play so he wasn't cluttering up the house. That's what Mom would say. Did you ever eat cherries, Jack?
Two men were assigned to search each batch of 10 cars, checking for possible interlopers aboard Adam's train. In the last 10 cars, the Sekhmen assigned were Barry Jackson and Horse McGinty, who figured they had an easy job. Most of the cars were dedicated to supplies, so they'd only 4 cars of people to worry about.
Sure, could be that a stowaway would hide himself in the storage car, but really, how hard is that Negwit gonna be to spot?
To Barry, it seemed kind of ironic, Horse saying that. By the time they had worked their way through to car 54, they had gotten the thing down to a routine. Check each compartment, poke their heads in, ask if everyone was okay and who they were meant to be, then move on. This car was split into 4 cabins along the port side wall, with a corridor stretching along the starboard side toward the door that opened onto the first of the storage units. The sliding door to the first cabin was open. The compartment was empty, an unmade bed to the right, and a tiny desk with the remains of a meal on it to the left. The cabin stank of rot gut, and insects had gathered in a sticky patch on the wood floor. The next door was closed.
Whoa, boy!
There was a Sekhmen lying in the bed, a tough guy by the name of Blake, whom Horse knew from a spate of rustling for the Baron a while back. Blake's hands were tied together and secured to a wooden pole built into the wall above him. And as far as Horse could tell, he was naked, a sheet granting him little modesty down below. Next to him, a dark-skinned, gaudy slut wearing an olive-green bra was snuggled up to him, a hand on Blake's hairy chest, smiling with a dazed expression on her face. On the other side of Blake was another gaudy, this one a pale-looking redhead with curves in all the right places, naked as the day she was born, the sheet tossed indifferently over her legs. The redhead was asleep, her face beside Blake's chest. The room smelled fiercely of body odor.
Ooh, excuse us, ma'am.
Horse tipped a finger to his brow as he stepped out of the room. Barry held the door a moment as Horse tried to slide it closed.
Oh, now, it's okay. That's Blake. I know him from a ways back.
Barry was looking at the gaudies dozing in the tiny bunk.
It ain't Blake we're looking at. Greedy SOB.
The second the door closed, Christy lifted her head out of the sedated Sekhmen's armpit.
This is disgusting.
I've sedated him 3 times in the past 12 hours. I think he's become a little sweaty.
Whose idea was this again?
They bought it, didn't they?
JB dropped down from the overhead rack, where the dead body of the piggy-eyed sec man still lay.
At least you didn't have to turn tricks with Corpse Boy up there.
How is he?
Decomposing. Should have got rid of him while I was gone.
It's on my to-do list, right after distracting the guards with my tits.
I knew they'd fall for it.
In the next cabin, Barry and Horace found an old, white-haired man neither of them recognized. The old man lay asleep in the bed.
You know this old duffer? He's one of the white coats?
I don't think so.
Reckon we'll show him to Adam then?
Old guy like this? I don't know. How'd you get aboard otherwise?
Maybe he is with the white coats then.
Eureka!
Still fully clothed, Doc swung his long legs over the side of the bunk and reached across for his ebony lion's head cane.
May I help you, gentlemen?
Well, we were just discussing whether you belong here or not, old man.
Whether I belong here? And who, might I ask, are you?
Well, Barry Jackson, and this here is Horace.
Yes, I know Horace already. I asked you who you were, young man.
We worked together somewhere? I can't think.
Moorhead, I do believe it was.
That must have been it.
Since his accident, Horace don't remember so good sometimes. Sorry, fella.
No. If you'll both excuse me, I do have important work to be getting on with.
Oh, sure thing.
As the sec man pulled the sliding door closed, Doc twisted the handle of his sword stick back into place. That had been close. He thought for a moment that he had been caught out, but once more it seemed that fortune favored the brave. A little bluff work went a long way, he knew. It was all in the delivery. He sat on the bunk and waited for JB and the others to reappear so that they could plan their next move. The reports came in one by one, as though his men were paying him tribute, until Adam had heard from all the teams. There was no one else on the train, no one who shouldn't be there. He sat in his Spartan cabin near the front of the train and pondered that. Why had they come out with this monstrous train again? When they started the operation years before, it had made sense to carry all the equipment, the materials to build the towers, and sometimes the very tracks that they traveled on. As Baron Burgess had refined the system, they had had to lay more track, and still the hulking workshops of the train had been required. But now, the supplies were barely needed anymore. The men had become lazy and inefficient. They hadn't trimmed the train down to a more manageable length because of Adam's paranoia that they might need something from the old storage units. Traveling across the dead terrain of North Dakota, the fear had always gripped him. What if they stalled? What if a rail broke, a point snapped, or become stuck? What if? And so he had insisted, despite what Burgess and his whitecoats had said, that they were to travel with everything, with all the supplies. A Ville in miniature, traveling on oiled wheels. For the first time ever, someone had come aboard his train and instigated a massacre. Men had been killed, good men, men he trusted, and moreover, he liked. But there was no one else aboard now. Just himself, his sec force, the three white coats, and a smattering of imprisoned children who were essential to the grand project. And the Bruja. Yes, the Bruja. The more distance he could put between himself and that creepy old woman, the happier Adam was. Maybe subconsciously, that was why he had kept the train at this impractical length. There was a buffer zone between them of more than 40 cars, and even then he felt her sometimes, picking through his dreams while he slept, her dry, brittle hands and talon-like nails sifting through his thoughts. He sat there in the darkness of his cabin, the curtains drawn against the rich afternoon sunlight, and he picked at his teeth. This would be the last go-round. This was the last mission before the project went to the final phase. Once that happened, they wouldn't need protection to travel the rails. No one would be left to challenge Baron Burgess and his loyal followers. They would be masters of all that they surveyed.
You have to eat.
Jack's head moved lethargically as he looked up at Maddie across the cage.
You have to eat or you'll get weak.
Jack nodded, almost imperceptibly. A sec man had come by sometime earlier and passed the children several platefuls of some unrecognizable meat. The children in the cell had devoured it eagerly, but Jack hadn't moved. He just sat there, his knees pulled close to his chest, his arms wrapped around them, staring off into space. Maddie had watched him, concerned at what he had to be thinking, at what his mind was dwelling on. Jack could see the boy's face, Francis Frankie and those hunks of meat. The boy, lying there on the poisonous soil, half his face gone and his life oozing away into the toxin-spoiled dirt. If he had just said something, just spoken up quicker, worked out his lie more swiftly.
Come on, Jack. It's good. It tastes good. It wasn't your fault.
I chilled plenty. Never this way.
That man did it. That man with the scars. They had you tied up, and there was nothing you could have done. I loved Francis Frankie. We all did. But there was nothing you could have done, Jack.
Should've. Should've stopped it.
No, Jack. Do you know why everyone's so quiet now? Why we're all sitting scared and sad and no one's really talking?
Because of me. Should've.
No. Everyone is sad because there was nothing we could do either.
Once the search team had departed, JB, Christy, Mildred, and Doc regrouped in the tiny compartment they had used as their base for the duration of the train's passage.
I want us out of here. If Ryan's still among the living, we'll find him and free him, that's for certain. But I don't want anyone going off half-cocked thinking they can take on the whole train.
And when are we to help Ryan? Come to that. When are we to help Jack as well?
We'll work on the assumption that they're still on board. When the opportunity arises, we'll know.
So, basically do nothing?
No train tracks go on forever.
Mildred shook her head, clearly deciding whether to challenge JB on this point. Christy, whose health had continued to improve, reached across and placed her hand on Mildred's arm, locking eyes with her. The silent instruction was clear. JB is the leader now. His decision stands, or we'll all get chilled. Having packed away his materials, JB stood by the compartment's door.
We're going to bed down in the storage units. Less chance of being disturbed, more chance to defend ourselves if someone comes knocking. Christy, you up to this?
I feel much better, thank you.
Any problems you call, anything, headaches, cramps, anything at all, you're our number one priority till we can get to Ryan and Jack. Anything else?
I do believe I am suffering a little from a headache myself.
Yeah, stress is getting to us all. Let's wrap this one up quick and get off this ghost train.
Together, the four of them made their way through the cars until they reached a unit full of metal sheets and jars of rivets. Despite Mildred's plea, they would be on the monstrous train for a further 3 days before they reached their ultimate destination. The train stopped at regular intervals, and the crew would examine the strange towers that had been constructed close to the tracks. Sometimes Mildred, Doc, or JB would sneak out and watch, and once, when she was feeling well, Christy took up a post by the roof hatch of their car and watched the operation at the front of the train under the waning moon of the night sky. The operation never varied. The white coats would examine the odd towers, compare their readings, and decide whether the balance of grayish liquid feeding the structures from beneath needed to be altered. Doc and Mildred proposed various possibilities to explain what that liquid was, and JB used his own field of expertise to run through possible mechanical oils, pastes, and unguents. But the actual nature of the liquid remained frustratingly elusive. In the storage car, just one from the back, JB constructed a shelter within the masses of metal plating that was stored there. With the help of the others, he shifted sheet steel so that they had a small burrow to retreat to, and a place where Christy could remain during the frequent periods when her health seemed to dip. The structure looked to be part of the storage system, a casual arrangement of the stocks held on board the train. JB spent several hours viewing it from various angles to ensure it looked camouflaged, hidden as it was in plain sight. However, in his own mind, the armorer became increasingly unhappy with the situation he had led them into. Their food supplies were dwindling, and he had insisted that they not raid the food stores, which were 10 cars away, unless they absolutely needed to. It wouldn't do to put themselves in any unnecessary danger this late in the game. Still, by hiding the companions in the shadows, it felt like he was failing to take charge. During their quieter moments, Mildred reassured him that he would know when it was time to act. She could sense his turmoil as much as any of them.
We're 2 men down, and Christy isn't in a reliable condition to help us. You're doing the right thing.
It feels wrong.
Sometimes deciding to do nothing can be the hardest choice of all.
As time went on, and their third day on the locomotive turned into a fourth, JB admitted that he had lost track of their passage.
How far?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. You started making the calculations as soon as you stepped on board. I know you did. And you have checked and triple-checked them ever since.
640 miles. That's how far we've traveled, assuming an average speed of 12 miles an hour, which roughly takes into account the stops.
And we know we should be heading to Grand Forks sooner or later, do we not?
Well,
if we continue to follow the loop I plotted out...
We'll get there in about a half day.
You have never yet given me reason to doubt your calculation abilities, John Barrymore. A half day it shall be. I will stake my cane on it.
Thanks, Doc.
The way Jack saw it, he couldn't free Ryan. He had spent two sleepless days mulling over the problem, approaching it from every angle. How do you untie a man from the front of a moving train without getting him killed? Jack didn't even consider his own safety in these scenarios. He just worked out the possible ways in which to free Ryan and promised to worry about himself once a viable solution came to him. The reality was this. As far as he knew, Ryan had been hanging there for more than 2 days, buffeted by the winds and assaulted by the elements. His arms and legs had to feel like jelly, no sensation left in them. If he was untied, he would simply drop, no strength left to save himself. And from where he was hung, any drop would result in him falling under the wheels of the massive engine. Jack would require some kind of winch or hoist to free Ryan, so that he could both untie him and hold the man in place. But then where would he take Ryan, assuming he could construct some kind of makeshift hoist? This all ignored the very real problem of getting there in the first place. Following the failed bust-out, a sec man had been charged with checking on the children every hour, leaving Jack with little time to work at an escape. The bravado he had shown JB when the armorer had found him in the cage had long since evaporated. There was simply no easy way out of the jail he had been placed in, and any escape would likely result in the execution of another child by way of punishment. Something that Jack had promised he would not let happen again. It was late into the night when the train ushered around the curving tracks and lumbered the last few miles to the forks. Adam had joined the driver at the rattling front engine as they came to the end of their journey. The driver was a stout man called Rhett, who never slept and was permanently wired up to some liquid form of jolt stim that pumped straight into his veins. His cabin was painted completely black, and only the lights of his equipment, the dials and gauges that allowed him to monitor the locomotive's progress, provided any illumination. Adam considered Rhett the single most reliable member of his squad. It never ceased to amaze him, that long approach to the Forks base. Years before, way back before the Megacull, the unit had been a U.S. Air Force base. Like most of the military facilities, the base had been destroyed, and whole sections were reduced to rubble. But Burgess, in the days when he was just a gangmaster himself, before he'd assumed the title of Baron, had seen value in sifting through the ruins and uncovering the old base's secrets. Baron Burgess had built his ville on the ruins of the military base, utilizing the underground facilities that had survived the attacks as an infrastructure to his grand design. They called it a ville, but really, besides several single-story outbuildings, it was one vast building, segmented to ensure it could stand, but stretching a half mile across the tortured landscape. It lurked on the horizon, a flat, low building, so huge that it was unavoidable, even in the semi-dark of the waning moon. Lights glowed in its windows, the flickering of fires, gleaming like stars trapped in the vast structure. Towers and posts and minarets jutted from the low roof, bristling into the indigo sky as though jabbing at a heaven that looked down and mocked the man within. As they got closer, Adam spotted the segment who patrolled around Forksville, striding through the fouled earth or eyeing the approaching train from their posts along the roof of the massive building.
Welcome home.
Doc shoved Jack's Colt Python into his waistband and smoothed his frock coat back in place to hide the weapon before joining the growing throng outside the train. He watched Christy walking ahead of him, seeing her weave a little as she stepped into the vast, low-ceilinged cavern that housed the train. She was still battling with ill health, more than 4 days after they had left the redoubt in Minot, and the pattern was still hard to predict. Before the companions had left the train, Christy had assured them that she felt fine, but it was clear that she was struggling, that the sickness had left her weak. She wore her hair up, tucked beneath the battered brown fedora that JB had loaned her for the infiltration of the train pirate camp, and had the Hessian blanket that she had retrieved when they left the sleeping cabin tossed over her shoulders. It would be difficult to disguise Christy's curvaceous female form, but wearing the shapeless blanket and hiding her vibrant hair helped draw attention away from her. JB and Mildred walked a few steps ahead of Christy, discussing their surroundings in low, urgent tones. Mildred's backpack disguised her a little, and she was hardly the statuesque beauty that Christy was. When the train stopped, the four of them had agreed to look outside, and once they confirmed that they were in a vast, roofed stopover, they had decided to take their chances outside among the mass of train people and other men and women who strolled through the huge cavernous space. The cavern was man-made, its flat sides curving inward toward the top as though domed. The ceiling was about three stories above the ground, and lighting was attached to catwalks and metal struts. The ceiling lamps were dim, their weak glow unable to penetrate the gloom of the huge room, and they were supplemented by portable lighting rigs dotted around the room. As they walked past one, Doc glanced over it and noticed the olive-green paint and the large white stenciled lettering along the side. It was clearly military, a period piece from pre-dark. The whole vast room had an indefinable military essence about it, Doc thought. Parts of the walls were patched together from old mill materiel. The area was large enough to hold the obscene length of the train, 60 cars stretching along one side of the room. The remainder was given over to a large flat space, a meeting room sufficient for a vast crowd in the hundreds or even thousands, with a few doors leading off the sides here and there, presumably into separate, smaller rooms. Doc estimated that there were perhaps 300 men and women here milling around, the majority of them armed. A raised dais was located in the center of the huge room, where a hooded, cloaked figure silently watched the proceedings as the three white coats and the commanding officer of the train trailed up the steps to the platform. A bank of light surrounded the dais, their glow soft, like the embers of a fire, a bubbling liquid visible within through the transparent windows. The crowd, made up of hard-faced men and women, Sekhmen, Mercies, and Gaudis like the ones the companions had seen aboard the train, made their way toward the raised dais. JB turned to face the others.
Me and Mildred are going to do a wreck on the train, see if we can find Ryan and Jack.
I'd like to look, too.
Stick with Doc. You're our backup, and we might just need some friends hidden in the crowd before too long.
JB glanced over his shoulder, watching as the glowing lights around the dais grew in intensity, then faded again. He saw two further figures had joined the others on the dais, and a chill went down his spine. The Bruja, accompanied by a Sekhmen. The frail old woman sat in a wheelchair, a skeletal-looking device with large wheels to each side. She sat silently, wrapped in a shawl, her arthritic hands shaking incessantly as a brawny Sekhmen pushed her to join the others on the raised platform.
Gotta get that Plasex.
JB grabbed Mildred and led the way back to the train. He pointed subtly toward the front of the train.
I want you to find Jack and Ryan if they're still on board. Most likely near the front of the train. That's where the cages are, and that's where we found Jack the first time out. Both of them may need medical attention.
What about you, JB?
I'll join you as soon as I can, but I got a few things I want to do first.
And what if I bump into Sekhmen guarding these cages?
I reckon most of them got off to stretch their legs and enjoy a taste of home cooking. Probably won't be more than half a dozen on board now.
Great.
Just then, Mildred caught a hustle of movement coming from the side and looked over towards it. Jack was being led out of the car, along with a handful of children, their heads bowed and ropes wrapped around their wrists, marching forward like a chain gang. The man with the long rifle led the group in the direction of the central dais, while a second man brandishing a crossbow took up the rear, urging the party onward. As they walked, JB and Mildred saw a similar group of chained children being forced from the car next to Jack's. Mildred nudged JB softly in the side and caught his eye, raising one eyebrow. JB shrugged in response and continued marching toward the front of the train. The Sekhmen led the two groups of children through the crowd toward the center of the vast room. As they watched them depart, Mildred and JB hastily reevaluated their objectives. It would be difficult to free Jack now without bringing down the wrath of the whole room.
I'm going to create a disturbance, but it'll take some doing. I need you to cover my back while I go get some.
Eyes alert, Mildred walked beside JB until they reached the 18th car from the engine. The armorer had memorized the important units of the train, and he knew precisely what he was looking for. This was the car where he and Ryan had found stocks of construction equipment, including that enticing stash of explosives. There was no side door on this unit, so he stepped between the cars and pulled himself up on the lip beneath the foremost door, while Mildred tried to look casual as she checked for anyone watching.
Do we have success?
The hooded figure on the dais was addressing the lead white coat, the older man of the three strong team. Adam stood beside the hooded man, and the Bruja sat in her wheelchair with a Sekhman waiting behind her, should she require to be moved. The eldest white coat stepped forward and dipped his head toward the hooded man in supplication.
We have tested this network as much as we can without going fully live. It's been on standby condition for 1 week, as you know, idling until we set the final phase in motion. I foresee absolute success, Baron Burgess.
Absolute.
We have seen definite vagal nerve stimulation in the subthalamic nuclei of test subjects. The tests have been brief of necessity, but the results have proved entirely satisfactory.
The head beneath the heavy hood turned, and the Baron addressed the Bruja.
Well, Muti Witch, what do you say?
He who controls the network will be Puppet Master. I can feel its power pulsing throughout the system now.
Good.
I am not the only one who feels this.
Burgess, Adam, and the three white coats all turned to look at the Bruja, stunned by her statement.
What? Who are you talking about?
There!
The Bruja's claw-like right hand moved toward the crowd around them. Her index finger slowly stretched out, and she pointed at a figure in the audience.
The woman.
Adam looked in the direction that the Bruja pointed and scanned the crowd. After a moment, he saw her, a tall woman that he hadn't seen before. She wore a dirty brown blanket over her shoulders to disguise her form and a battered fedora on her head.
Get that stupid bitch!
Suddenly, Christy was surrounded by hostile forms. A man grabbed her from behind, yanking her arm painfully high up her back.
Get off me!
Adam says you're needed up there, sweet meat!
Christy bent forward, flipping the man who had grabbed her arm so that he flew over her head and into the man who had just spoken. The pair stumbled, and they both fell to the floor, along with JB's hat, which had disguised her vivid red hair. To Christy's right, she saw Doc whip the hidden sword from its sheath inside his ebony cane. But more Sekhman had turned at the incident, and he was suddenly lost to her in the shifting crowd. She needed to get out of there, to get away from these people, but as she looked left and right, she realized that there was nowhere to run. She ducked her head and steamed into the nearest Sekhman, knocking him flat on his back and charging forward. Doc watched Christy fight her way through the Sekhman until they finally overwhelmed her. From her spot beside the train, Mildred watched as the blur of red hair appeared in the middle of the skirmish. Christy had been discovered. Mildred looked back to the car door.
Come on, JB, time's a-wastin'.
She turned back to look at the proceedings in the crowd and saw Christy being dragged up the steps onto the dais. The figure in the hood was leaning forward, examining Christy the way a jeweler would evaluate a precious gem or a butcher a piece of meat. This situation was getting further and further out of their control. Mildred saw a large man swinging a heavy mace come running toward her. She ducked as the mace rushed toward her face.
You don't want to meet you. I slept with every whore on this train and I ain't never seen you. You come here to risk your never boy.
Mildred sprinted along the side of the train and weaved in between two cars. She heard the Sekhman following behind her. She clambered over the coupling that linked the two cars, then leapt out the other side and ran along the starboard edge of the train toward the engine. She looked back, seeing the man pulling himself through the tight gap between the cars, his gun at the ready. Target revolver in hand, Mildred crawled beneath the train, pulling herself along with her elbows and driving forward with her knees and feet as she tried to put distance between herself and the Sekhman. She turned and saw the man's feet as he ran alongside the train. Mildred turned, rolling on her side, and aimed her revolver at the man's feet. In car 18, JB stuffed as much Plasex into his pockets as he could and grabbed a handful of the sticks of dynamite. Looking at it closely, he realized that this was all pre-dark military issue. From discussions with Mildred and studying his ancient maps, JB had located an old Air Force base in the area now known as the Forks. All this stuff, the train, its contents, the crazy station that they now found themselves in, all of it had echoes of pre-dark military equipment. From this evidence, he concluded that the Baron and his crew had built their wealth and their plans on the Air Force remnants, which accounted for a lot of the impressive technology, such as the Gosling Jennies that he had seen them using. In JB's experience, there was a lot of trouble associated with old military equipment in the wrong hands. Baron Burgess watched as the impressive Titian-haired woman was forced up the steps to join him and his advisors.
What manner of woman are you?
Christy shook her head, her lips tight, but she found somehow that she couldn't do it, couldn't look away. The low hood left his face in shadow, but his eyes, their whites tainted to a sick yellow, their irises a vivid emerald, burned into her from its depths.
Answer your baron!
I'm just a norm.
It is pointless to lie to me. I can feel a lie as you speak it, and I can unpick your thoughts at will.
Christy tried to look away, turning her head from the hooded figure in front of her. She couldn't seem to do it. It was like she was trapped by the hypnotic stare of a cobra.
I don't.
It was becoming harder to string complete sentences together. Her head was pounding. Her brain felt as though it was swelling, pushing against the sides of her cranium.
A demonstration. A demonstration for Christy Rolfe.
He knew her name. This Baron, a man she had never seen before, knew her name. And Christy had felt him. He took it, plucked it from her mind, wrenched it from her thoughts like a tiny thing, a splinter pulled from under a fingernail, a little pop of pain. What manner of man was this Baron? His wrists tied, Jack shuffled behind Humblebee and Mark in the line of his cellmates as they were guided toward the raised platform in the center of the vast room.
What's happening, Jack?
Jack turned back, glancing over his shoulder at Maddie.
Don't know.
You!
It was Adam, the scarred commanding officer from the train, the one who had killed Francis Frankie. Jack scanned the dais's other occupants. A sec man stood behind a wheelchair-bound old woman at the right of the platform. Beside them, the three white coats that he had seen tending to the tower back in Fairburn were waiting patiently, riffling through notebooks and talking quietly among themselves. Adam and the hooded man were standing near to the front of the dais, watching as the sec man stood in front of them. At the far left, with an armed man on either side, stood Christy Rolfe, her figure hunched over as though she was having trouble standing straight, and her arms wrapped around her chest as though to keep warm.
Your demonstration, Christy Rolfe!
Jack watched in growing concern as the sec man standing next to him pulled his sidearm from its holster and calmly positioned it beneath his own chin. Jack turned back to Maddie.
Look away.
Christy took a step back from the hooded figure of Baron Burgess and bumped into one of the sec men behind her. She looked up at expressionless faces. These men had been full of life a moment before, yet now they were completely impassive at the horrific fate that had just befallen their colleague, their comrade in arms. The whole atmosphere was charged, something she could almost taste now, something so very wrong about everything around her. Baron Burgess turned to look at her with those piercing emerald eyes once more, and she felt herself shrink under his stare.
You've gone pale, but I see that you're beginning to understand. You see, they are all my puppets. Everyone in this room. Everyone in the state. And soon, everyone in the whole of Deathlands.
The driving pain in Christy's head reached a crescendo, and all that she could see was the Baron's eyes through a pinprick in the darkness of her failing vision. Then, nothing. Mildred scurried beneath the train, pulling herself away from the sec man as his blood-drenched boot trod toward her. She was at the end of the car now, and she would have to break cover to crawl beneath the next one. She looked ahead, mentally preparing herself, before diving out between the cars.
Now I got up!
JB stood behind him, holding his Uzi low to his body, with a steadying hand beneath the barrel.
Come on, Mildred. Let's get moving.
Mildred rolled out from under the train and put a restraining hand on JB's shoulder as he started to jog in the direction of the rear of the train.
Wait, I think we have another complication. They've got Christy.
Just when you think it's as bad as it can be, the whole deal finds a way of going even farther south.
JB looked up and down the length of train.
8 minutes. Find Ryan and get him off the train.
8 minutes. Check.
Mildred leapt into the nearest car and started making her way forward through the cages. JB stopped her long enough to hand her a pack of thermals.
Distribute them every few cars.
Christy felt something plucking at her head, something inside her skull. Slowly, wearily, she opened her eyes to narrow slits, and surveyed her surroundings in a long-established survival tactic.
That's it, Christy. Wake up now.
The strange witch woman and the hooded Baron were looking at her closely, along with a man that she recognized as the psychopathic leader of the train crew, who had ordered the burning of the people that had attacked his train.
What happened?
Baron Burgess turned to Adam, his second in command.
I've never known someone to be affected so completely. It's exquisite.
Why does it affect her, do you think?
The Bruja never took her eyes from the red-haired woman sitting on the floor in front of them.
Because she's like me, an Earth Witch.
Is that right? Are you a witch, Christy Roth?
What are you talking about?
She doesn't know it, perhaps, but she is one of mine. The power of nature flows through her. I felt it back on the train.
What's going on?
Can you feel it? In the air all around you. That is my power.
I've felt it for so long, hearing my head kicking like a mule.
It hurts now, but it is a good hurt, I promise you. It is the power of good, something so rare in this accursed land.
Good?
Once upon a time, there was a fantastical nation called the United States of America. A nation so fantastic that they actually called it the Land of the Free. But the Land of the Free had enemies, and so it protected itself until the nukes came, and it could protect itself nevermore. One of the ways that this great nation protected itself was by exerting control, Christy Roth. Control of hearts and minds. There were many programs. MK Ultra, MK Delta Chatter, Osterly, Artichoke, Paperclip. Hundreds of these systems were tested, each experimenting with ways to control the one great unfettered, the human mind. Do you see it yet, Christy? I think that you do. The theories were all here, locked in the vast underground vaults of the base. I just needed a way to make them work.
Why?
To serve the world. The land of the free, the free lands, became what you see around you, the Deathlands. In 100 years, mankind has reverted to a semi-savage state, preying on one another, creating nothing but pain and violence. But I shall change all of that once my grand project is engaged.
I don't see how...
Discipline of the mind! Everyone working for one true purpose, cleansed of their impure desires to steal and to hurt and to kill. Under my control, those thoughts will be purged.
Mind control, Christy realized. She saw it all in a brilliant flash of comprehension. This man, Baron Burgess, had a noble dream to unite all the Deathlanders into a society, into a true civilization once more. Except something was not right. That was obvious. Somehow his noble dream had been corrupted. The death and violence that went with the train wherever it appeared was proof of that. As instructed by JB, Mildred had checked every one of the cage-bearing cars. There was no one aboard, no sec men, no children, and certainly no sign of Ryan. She had sprinted through all the empty cages, through a store car that showed clear signs of a firefight, two crew quarters, a laboratory car coupled to a car full of equipment. After that was a bland room with heavy drapes over the windows, another car filled with techie stuff, including spotlights on a rig with a portable generator painted in a familiar military green, and finally out onto a flatbed with a heavy cannon on it. She checked her wrist chron. She had less than 4 minutes left. Standing on the flatbed, she looked ahead. There was the vast unit that presumably held the fuel for the locomotive, and then there was the engine.
Sorry, Ryan.
She stepped off the flatbed unit on the starboard side, away from the congregation in the vast chamber. Reluctantly, Maddie stepped forward. Despite her reticence, she held her head high, looking challengingly at the people on the dais above. A sec man behind her slammed the butt of his gun into her back to hurry her along as she marched toward the dais. She turned back for a moment, and her eyes locked with Jack's.
Goodbye.
JB weaved through the crowd and joined Doc.
What's going on, Doc?
I have no idea, but it seems that this may be our last chance to free both Christy and young Jack.
I've set charges throughout the Loco Wag. We got about 2 minutes before they blow, and then this whole place will turn into chaos.
And what of Ryan?
Mildred's on it.
Well, she's going to have to be quick.
They watched as the girl in the white nightdress was made to stand in front of the raised dais.
I don't like the look of this.
You and me both, Doc. Reckon you can get the blaster to Jack?
I intend to do my level best.
It works best with the young.
Baron Burgess focused his stare on the Asian girl standing in front of him.
Their brains are still forming. They still have the capacity to accept me.
I don't think... No, she's not accepting you. That girl is not accepting you.
Christy turned away as the girl dropped to the floor and began punching and kicking at it with all her strength.
Please stop!
Then, Maddie pulled herself upright, kneeling as she looked up at the Baron. Suddenly, violently, she pushed forward, bending at the waist, and slammed her forehead into the solid concrete floor, headbutting the unforgiving surface again and again. There was blood on Maddie's face now, seeping through her hairline, trickling into her eyes, over her nose, and down her cheeks. But she wouldn't stop.
Give me your fucking axe!
The sec man handed over the axe, and Adam tested its weight in his hands. Then, he walked over to Maddie, where she continued hitting the floor in a strange mockery of genuflecting. The girl's headless body knelt in place as Adam carried his bloody trophy back to the hooded figure on the dais. It was only by chance that Mildred had decided to walk around the front of the train. She had seen the exterior once by night from the window of the rented room in Fairburn, and she had been half convinced it was something come alive from a nightmare. The jutting spikes and flaming holes along the matte black side still gave her that impression, even up close, and she suppressed a shiver as she admired the metallic beast. Then, quite unexpectedly, she saw Ryan, tied to the front of the train, hanging just above the floor by his wrists and ankles. His face was caked in dirt, and his head hung low, no strength left to hold it up.
Ryan! Ryan, can you hear me?
Ryan's head lolled on his shoulders. He was clearly well out of it. Mildred untied the final strap, binding Ryan's wrist, and eased him gently down.
Ryan, wake up!
Ryan was breathing and didn't seem to have any obvious wounds. He was just exhausted.
Come on, Ryan. We have to get out of here right now.
Mildred checked her wrist chron again. They had 1 minute before JB's surprise kicked into action.
What happened? Mildred, was that you?
Large as light, but not for much longer unless we get away from this train.
Ryan tried to stand, but he slumped back on the ground.
Can't feel my legs or my arms. Well, what the hell happened?
I guess you've been hanging from the front of the train for the past 3 days. I'll help you get out of here. Come on!
On hands and knees, Mildred shuffled along next to Ryan, half dragging him as he crawled slowly away from the train. She guided them over to a glass-walled control room that she had spotted across from the train, then dragged Ryan into the room, and they sat together beneath one of the control desks. She glanced at her wrist chron once again.
What have I missed?
All of the sec men have gathered in the big reception room outside. Jack and a load of kids are chained up ready for the slaughter, and some insane baron has decided to make Christy his pet.
Nothing important, then.
Oh, almost forgot. JB has a plan.
So I hear.
The younger male white coat had been handed the dead girl's head by the scarred CO, and had taken a powered bone saw to it. He swiftly cut into the forehead, splitting the skull and flipping the top of the head back. Inside, the brain sat snugly in the cranium, glistening with moisture. Beside JB, Doc's eyes lit up, as though hit by a sudden realization. Rubber gloves over his hands, the white coat had removed the brain and squeezed it in his hands, watching the trickle of liquid drip from it. The brain was placed in a container where it swam in similarly colored, mushy gray liquid.
Of course, they want the gray matter.
Get to Jack. We need him now.
Doc shoved his way through the crowd, most of whom were transfixed by the burning wreckage that had been the center of the train just moments before. Finding himself beside the children, Doc yanked the cold python from its hiding place at the small of his back.
Might I be of some assistance, Mr. Lauren?
God, I never see you again.
I'm like the proverbial bad penny, Jack. You should know that by now.
As soon as the first explosion rocked the cavernous room, Christy felt her thoughts snap into focus once more. The pain in her head abating, still there, but abating. Being near this Baron Burgess was like holding her head in a clamp. She had to get away. She turned, scanning the crowd of what had been a moment before, revelers. They had all turned to look at the flames that engulfed the center of the monstrous train at the far side of the room. Christy glanced back, looking at the people on the raised platform. They too were entranced, watching the growing inferno that had engulfed their train, all except the strange old woman with the blood-colored tears painted on her cheek. She just sat in her wheelchair, a serene expression on her lips.
My train! What has happened to my glorious train?
Adam shook his head and turned to look at his master. His eyes widened when he saw the red-haired woman standing beside the Baron, pulling back her fist.
Baron Burgess!
Christy stood staring, her follow-up punch forgotten, as she looked into the revealed face of Baron Burgess. He was entirely bald, and his exposed skin looked old and haggard. His bright eyes were a fierce green within the bloodshot yellows where the whites should have been. Wiring sprung from the top and back of his head, linked through open wounds straight onto the pulsing mass of brain that could be seen through a Swiss cheese sequence of drilled holes. The man had been repeatedly trepanned, and she could see that the attached wires disappeared into the back of the robe, and most likely through it, and into the floor below. The Baron, she realized then, had never moved more than a few feet, and all the time she had seen him.
You look horrified, Christy Roth!
Are you some kind of bot?
To achieve perfection, one has to be willing to make sacrifices. This was the only way to truly ensure that the system would respond to my commands. So I willingly became part of it.
Christy looked at the bald man, the wires jutting from his skull, and she felt a twinge of sadness. Perhaps, somewhere in the distant past, Baron Burgess had been an idealist. Perhaps he had had not a plan, but a dream, a vision. But somewhere on his quest to fulfill his ideal to create a working, ordered civilization from the wreckage that was the Deathlands, he had given himself over to the system of its implementation, and he had given up a little piece of humanity in the process. She saw it all then. The harvesting of children's malleable brains that acted as the transmitters in the towers.
What kind of monster does this to himself?
But Christie's punch failed to connect. The strength in her muscles ebbed away, like water through netting, and she just sank straight down, as though collapsing in on herself.
We don't need my glorious train anymore, girl!
Doc quickly pulled out his sword stick.
Watch your hands!
As Doc severed the rope around Jack's wrists, the crowd of people around them were starting to react now. Doc handed Jack his gun and pulled his trusty Lamar from its holster.
Shoot is still good.
JB oiled it for you.
Jack scrambled up the abbreviated flight of steps and onto the dais. He could see Christy flailing as she dropped to the floor, and a bald-headed man poised over her, grinning maliciously. Beside the bald man was the scarred man who had killed his friends, Francis, Frankie, and Maddie, his face away from Jack as he watched the burning wreckage of the train.
Ah, fuck! You shot my fucking leg! You piece of shit!
You're the one about to be fucked! Bullet for tongue. Ah!
3 days Ryan had hung there, with no food to eat, and only the little rainwater that hit his face to drink. And all it had done was make him meaner, more focused than ever. Mildred watched in admiration as Ryan pushed himself up from the floor and rolled his shoulders to ease the tension in his muscles.
Come on, Mildred. Time to end this thing.
Outside the control room, it was turmoil. People were running in all directions as fire engulfed the monstrous train. Flames leapt up the wall next to the burning train, and Mildred realized that they were lucky to depart their cover when they had. In a few moments, those flames would spread and cover the doorway. Ahead of her, Ryan walked heavily, his muscles still aching. He led her around the front of the train, not so much as wasting a single glance on the area where he had hung for the past 3 days. No curiosity while there was a job to do. Flames lapped at the wheels and rear of the engine, and the matte paint blistered as heat engulfed it. Ryan just continued on, surveying the scene until he spotted Christie's bright hair on the dais at the room's center. Head down, he marched toward the dais, with Mildred jogging along beside him, making their way through the startled mob. Lying supine on the floor of the dais, Christie kicked with her heels and pushed herself backward, away from the leering Baron.
Come to me, Christie Roth. Don't try to resist.
Resist this, Burgess!
The bullet missed him by a fraction of an inch, leaving a bloody gash on his cheek.
Christie!
Christie's eyes darted across for a moment, and she saw Ryan and Mildred rushing up the steps and onto the stage. In the turmoil, the old woman and her wheelchair had disappeared, Christie realized. When had that happened?
You shouldn't piss off Christie!
Christie raised the barrel of her gun and targeted the back of the Baron's head. At the same time, Ryan pulled the trigger on his Sig Sauer.
It's okay. It's all over now.
But it wasn't, and Christie was the first to feel it. Her headache had been getting disarmingly more urgent in the last 3 seconds, ever since Baron Burgess had taken 2 bullets to the head.
He's not dead, Ryan.
What did you say?
He's not dead. The Baron is not dead.
Ryan turned, aware of the heavy weight of his own skull atop his neck. It was like deep sea diving, moving through the pressured water, trying to get the momentum going. The robed figure of the Baron lay there, a puddle of blood and brain matter spilled from the top of his head. Beside the corpse, Mildred had fallen to the floor, her eyes clenched tight in agony. Ryan saw her slowly raise her heavy head.
What's happening? Oh, he's in my head!
Ryan looked at Christie in shock, trying to make sense of the statement she had just made. But by then, it was too late.
Of course! So simple!
The voice went farther than the room. It went beyond the spectators here, wending through the skeletal transmitters that sat in the earth beside the railroad tracks, rocketing across the whole state and staggering farmers working in the pre-dawn fields, the bills, the broken wreckage of the shattered cities. Everyone, awake or asleep, felt that voice in their head.
I never even thought. Freed of the body, I have utter control of the mind.
Ryan noticed the wiring that ran from the body of the Baron into the floor. The same type of wiring that could be seen sprouting from his skull. Beneath the Baron, on the floor of the platform, there were holes and circuits. The whole dais formed some kind of machine. The mad bastard had wired himself into the machine itself. His whole life stuck to this spot, attached by an umbilical cord of wiring.
This is the ultimate! The grand project works better than I could have possibly dreamed! The system responds to my commands better than I ever hoped! I just needed the absolute freedom to embrace it! I am control!
JB saw Mildred lying atop the dais, the blood pooling beside her face, and he wished there was some way to help her.
Mildred! How do you clean out a brain?
Mildred saw JB gesture toward the floor below her with the barrel of the Uzi, and she started to realize what he meant. She rolled, pushing herself away from the floor, and shrugged out of the armholes on her backpack. She dug into the backpack. From the scrounged medical supplies there, she pulled out a hypodermic syringe, her hand shaking as she held it up to her eyes, trying to see if it contained anything. Liquid. It held liquid, crystal clear, with a trace of foam at the top of the container.
Put him to sleep!
Ryan had heard Mildred, had watched her rooting through the bag. He saw the syringe in her hand, and he ignored everything else. His vision was almost gone. A narrow circle surrounded by thick, inky blackness was all that remained.
Flame crawled across the dais on hands and knees, his eye focused on the syringe in Mildred's hand. Suddenly, like moving at high speed, he was there, his hand falling over Mildred's, clasping the little plastic cylinder of the syringe. Atop the dais, Ryan stood, his knees buckling a little at the stress, his frame unsteady, swaying as though a tree in the breeze. His right hand held the hypodermic syringe filled with sedative, the thin metal needle twinkling in the flames of the destroyed train. He looked down at the Baron's corpse, looking for the strange wiring he had noticed that connected the Baron's body to the machinery below. There were gaps there, small tunnels through the floor that held the wiring in place. Ryan staggered two steps forward until he was upon the Baron's robed figure. Then he lunged, collapsing to the floor, his right arm extended above him. He ripped at the wiring, yanked a strand of it free, opening the hole into the base of the platform. The aperture was so slim, a tiny breach in the vast unit. Ryan imagined that he might see the liquefied brain matter rushing beneath, but it was just a hole, thin and characterless. He brought his fist down and drove the thin needle of the hypodermic into the little gap in the surface of the floor. Once he was done, Ryan slumped to the floor as all the thoughts in his mind burned away. Blackness, nothingness, the end of the all.
No.
Ryan abruptly regained consciousness as a hand pressed against his chest and rocked him awake. He opened his eye and looked up into Christie's smiling face.
Wake up, lover. We have to get out of here.
What happened?
He's gone, but the whole base is going up in smoke. We need to get moving.
Ryan sat up, his muscles protesting, and saw the thick black smoke that was filling the hall beneath the high ceiling. All around the dais were the fallen bodies of the Baron's men, many of them struggling to rouse themselves, as though from a hard night's drinking. There was blood splattered across the room, and many of the people wore streaks of crimson across their faces. Ryan scanned the area and saw JB crouched beside a group of a dozen children, shaking them awake. To his side, Doc was nodding his muzzy head as he tried to shake off the effects of the mental invasion. In the distance, the train was nothing more than a burning streak of tortured wood and metal, and the wall beside it and floor beneath were burning furiously. Mildred stood beside the steps of the dais, her familiar backpack strapped across her shoulders, and she looked all around until she saw something behind the platform.
Jack! Come on, lover. It's time I saved you.
The companions regrouped, and with the frightened children, made their way through the crowd and out of the burning station. Outside, the sun was just tripping over the horizon in the east, a new dawn breaking. Ryan leaned heavily against Christie, but she took the burden with ease and good grace. Her strength had finally returned.
What happened there? In the end.
The Baron's psyche was transferred into his machinery on death, I think, and the whole process boosted his psionic abilities to a terrifying level. Don't ask me how. The guy was wired into his brain transmitter, and I'm damned if I can figure the whole logic of the thing.
Well, the heck of it is, the confounded system actually worked at the end.
For a while.
Bringing up the rear, Mildred and a very tired-looking Jack made sure that there were no stragglers among the child escapees.
You think that was Burgess's plan?
He gave up so much to achieve his dream. It was kind of touching when he told me. But he would never have given up his body like that.
So, where is he now?
He's gone. The sedative was transmitted through the system, just like his alpha waves. When you put him to the final sleep, well, I can't feel their agony anymore. They're all sleeping now.
Humblebee, the 8-year-old girl with the lopsided bunches in her hair, tugged at Jack's sleeve. Her face looked sad and frightened, but she wasn't crying at least.
Will we see Maddie again?
She asleep with the others. She won't be coming back.
I miss her.
Me too.
Jack parted from the group and pointed to a small shack on the outskirts of the old military compound.
Stables.
Jack was right. As Ryan and the others looked, they saw several riders mount up and head toward the mountain paths to the north.
Reckon they take orphans at Fairburn?
JB indicated the children.
It seemed like a nice enough vill, so I should think that they will. Perhaps even help some of these lost souls find their rightful families.
But not Maddie.
Then let's head back to the redoubt and mine it. Swing by Fairburn. Make us a few apologies while we're there. See if they have people who will take these kids in.
Together, the companions each secured a steed, and with the children sharing two or three to a horse, made their way across the plain and away from the wrecked military base at Grand Forks. North Dakota, they agreed, was a hell of a place to visit.
Deathlands Alpha Wave is a Graphic Audio production. Deathlands and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2009, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Amanda Thickpenny, Mort Shelby, Tony Penny, James Lewis, Nanette Savard, Ren Casey, Ken Jackson, and Joe Brack. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for Graphic Audio and directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at roadstops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
What have you done, girl? And it was you. Don't you lie to me. Last man coming into the way told me a gemstone hit the Father Abbot, and that all the monks were amazed that someone had struck so hard and from so far away. They had wards in place against such attacks, so it said. So they and I know the assassin was a person of great power with the stones. Only one person I know could have done that.
Avalyn Desbris could have torn his head from his shoulders.
And Avalyn is dead. We both know that. And we know, too, who it was that has his gemstones. And one of those stones was Lodestone, was it not? And it was a Lodestone that hit the Father Abbot. So where is your Lodestone, girl?
Gelsepini has suffered greatly at the hands of Father Abbot Marquardt.
She acted rashly and without regard for greater events about her.
Events that she could not know of, since we have not contacted her.
Events that include the child in her womb? That fact alone should have stayed her hand. The Abelican Church will realize almost absolute control over the city now, and they will orchestrate every movement of King Danube, using security as an excuse. Your friend has cost us much.
Jill the Assassin.
You hit me hard, my dear. Do you see what you have done to me? And only by the power of the gemstones am I able to paint an image of my face as it was. And only by the telepathic power of the Soul Stone am I able to communicate so that those around me think that I am speaking to them. I know you, and I am coming for you.
Father Abbot, you must flee.
Hinder her not. And know that when this day is through, our power will be even greater in Hans the Bear. Begone!
Don't miss the cataclysmic conclusion of the third book of the Demon Wars saga, The Demon Apostle, Part 3.
Falcon, Mrs. Custer told me something that I'd never heard before. She told me that you were with her husband when he was killed.
I wasn't with him at the exact time he was killed. I was with Bentine and Reno when the general was killed.
Why haven't I heard this about you before?
Because my being there was an accident of sorts. A lot of good men gave their last full measure of devotion on that day. I never felt it was right to detract from their honor by interjecting myself.
I wonder, Falcon, would you share the story with me now?
It's been over 50 years, and I've never told this story to anyone before. Not sure I can do it justice. Well, I'll warn you, it's a long story.
I'm a novelist, Falcon. I deal in long stories. Please, go ahead.
Well now, the year 1876 was what historians would call an eventful year. In Philadelphia, they celebrated our country's centennial. Colorado became a state. They invented the telephone. And at a lonely place in Montana, General Custer and 265 brave men were killed.
Colonel McAllister, this way! Damn! You're one hell of an engine fighter, Falcon. I've been at this game for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
The Colorado Home Guard is missing 100 rifles. It looks like we just found a few of them.
You mean in addition to the Gatling guns we're looking for, there's also a bunch of repeating rifles out there?
Sweet fancy Moses, look at that!
Have you ever seen that many Indians at one time?
No, sir, I have not. Two Bears was right. These engines is coming from everywhere.
We have to tell Custer about this. I don't think he has any idea what he's letting himself in for.
You don't really know the General all that well, do you?
I haven't known him very long. Why do you ask?
Because it ain't gonna make no never mind what we tell him. He has his mind made up to go after the engines, and that's exactly what he's gonna do.
We've got them this time! We've got them, boys! Trumpeter Martin!
Don't miss the saga of Falcon McAllister at the Little Bighorn and Eagles 14, Bloodshed of Eagles. Available now in Graphic Audio.
What is your name?
Anya Creed.
I see.
Who are you?
My name is Agamemnon. We have your passport here.
They took it from me when I was kidnapped.
We will videotape your beheading and then broadcast it all over the world.
Beheading?
Are you afraid to die?
I faced death before.
I will kill you!
Don't move. Who are you?
My name is Anya Creed. The Abu Sayyaf kidnapped me several days ago. I have no idea where I am.
You live here, or are you just passing through?
Gunnery Sergeant Vic Gutierrez, United States Marine Corps.
Something bothering you, Vic?
I got this feeling like someone's keeping an eye on us.
Excuse me!
What happened?
Anya, wake up and pay attention.
Where are we?
You are in a cavern located far beneath the surface of the jungle. You're wasting your time. You would need to be a lot stronger than you are in order to break free. Besides, you are to be sacrificed to our god.
I don't believe you.
Very well. You believe now, don't you?
Oh, great.
Oh, crap.
Rogue Angel 18. Sacrifice. In Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.